Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast, the complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 9, February 28, 2011. Run, Ron, Run, America Needs President Ron Paul, by Mark Anderson. Washington, D.C. Once again, Representative Ron Paul, Republican, Texas, won the presidential straw poll at the recent annual Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, an event loaded with neoconservatives who want to marginalize or exclude pro-peace conservatives, such as Representative Paul and his son, Senator Rand Paul, Republican, Kentucky, largely because Paul and son want to keep military spending on the table for possible major budget reductions. This development, wherein Ron Paul received 30% of the vote, came amid the usual evasive reporting by the mainstream media, reports that echo those in 2008 when Representative Paul, a medical doctor from Lake Jackson, Texas, threw his hat in the ring but was virtually invisible to a corporate media big party alliance that does not want to admit that their dull, manufactured presidential candidates are not making the grade. For example, a South Texas daily, The Monitor, in the February 13th edition, reported that Representative Paul had won the straw poll as the first choice of the 3,742 who voted at the CPAC. Paul's 30% was followed by former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney's 23%, about the same as last year. But the vote was highly fractured for the other potential candidates who visited the CPAC podium, including Texas Governor Rick Tolroad Perry, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, Tycoon Donald Trump, Representative Michelle Bachmann, Republican Minnesota, and others that inspire yawns. Alone among the GOP candidates, Representative Paul's record during 22 years in Congress proves that he means what he says, and his words are not the usual phony campaign rhetoric. The establishment, needless to say, would rather take a say-anything approach than fully admit that none of their potential nominees excite the throngs of GOP voters looking for another Ronald Reagan, along with those who don't know what they're looking for. So AFP encourages undecided voters to reconsider their outlook and try backing Representative Paul. No one ever said he was perfect. His views on trade and monetary policy are debatable on populist and common sense grounds. However, this nation has had more than enough of the road to perdition laid by the neoconservative warmongers. And Representative Paul, who airs honest views and does not pander to what people want to hear, would challenge the U.S. spending and foreign policy that is financially and morally bankrupting the nation. For that reason alone, Ron should run. Fox News caught sabotaging Paul. Gary Franchi, author of the online Realty Report, reports that Fox News deceived the public by substituting 2010 Conservative Political Action Conference footage for 2011 footage. The 2010 footage on Fox, passed off as 2011 footage, featured a crowd that, by the sound of it, was not very enthused about Representative Ron Paul's CPAC presidential straw poll win, and booed loudly when the moderator, the same guy both years, announced Paul's victory, his second win in as many years. The actual 2011 footage's audio, however, has sustained cheering and no discernible booing. Concerned readers are asked to file complaints by calling Fox at 212-301-3000, fax 212-301-4229, or email comments@foxnews.com. A letter writer at AFP said, "It doesn't matter whether I am pro-Ron Paul or not. This is a matter of journalistic integrity." Neocons condemn Paul's anti-war stance. The traditional conservative youth group, Young Americans for Freedom, has kicked Representative Ron Paul, Republican, Texas, out of the group for his delusional and disturbing alliance with the fringe anti-war movement. In an official statement, YAF Senior National Director Jordan Marks said Paul's beliefs border on treason because he does not support the war on terror or American interventionism abroad. Ironically, one of YAF's founding principles notes that American foreign policy must be judged by this criterion. Does it serve the just interests of the United States? The group's presence at the recent CPAC gathering contributed to the event's strong bias toward an interventionist foreign policy. Page 2, personal from the editor, Mideast over Midwest. Former Congressman Jim Trafficant, who has been a regular AFP columnist for more than a year, points out in this edition on page 17 that our Washington legislators spend far more time discussing and approving expenditures for the Mideast than they do for the Midwest, much in the way that the financial system strongly favors Wall Street over Main Street. Check out what Jim has to say on this matter, which includes excerpts from his House floor speeches. These snippets are from Jim's glory days when he fought the powerful forces of military interventionism, forces that stress the need for billions of bucks in foreign aid to grease the skids for a world warfare scheme that is passed off as an object of patriotism. However, it is nothing of the sort. This is the main dividing line among attendees of the recent Conservative Political Action Conference. Many Republicans could hardly goose-step any higher as they uncritically accept the laughable notion that for freedom to live, it must be extinguished, as easily happens when the imperial warfare state that America has sadly become engineers a surveillance society at home to make sure dissent does not become strong enough and unified enough to rupture the profit stream that is wrought from spilling blood around the globe every day of every year. Many conservatives can only find patriotism in the military realm. If you talk about buying American goods, restoring manufacturing, getting rid of the interest-bearing creation of money, and so on, these patriots find little to be excited about. But when it comes to policing the world to hunt some alleged mastermind of terror, they light up with blind zeal. As Richard Walker reports inside this edition on page 14, war is becoming a for-profit business in which private mercenaries are rented by governments to put more boots on the ground and supplant regular government troops, thereby enabling governments to claim that troop reductions are happening when they are really substituting private commandos for government regulars. Think about this the next time you hear about troop reductions. I also want to thank host Marion Kindig for a great program at the National Press Club February 9th that my assistant Angie and I attended in order to cover a talk by former Ambassador Anne Wright. Look for a report in the next AFP. Also, check out the wraparound for this edition that promotes several books by AFP writer Pat Shannon. Lots of good reading awaits those who order. Mark Anderson. South Carolina mulls alternate money. South Carolina could soon join a growing number of states that are quietly preparing for the perceived collapse of the U.S. dollar by introducing a state-sanctioned alternative currency. State Senator Lee Bright, Republican Roebuck, recently introduced legislation in South Carolina's legislature that backs the creation of a new state currency that could protect the financial stability of the Palmetto State in the event of a breakdown of the Federal Reserve System. So far, bills have been entered into legislatures in Virginia, as reported on this page last week, and in Utah, calling for creating official currencies outside the Federal Reserve's control. South Texas, active war? A Rio Grande Valley, Texas network news affiliate reports that video stills received by the news outlet show what appears to be the Mexican military crossing into the United States illegally. According to Channel 5's report, the pictures clearly show the international boundary that separates the United States from Mexico, and what authorities on this side of the border seem to think is a truck packed with armed men crossing into the United States. U.S. agents shot in Mexico. A U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent was shot and killed and another wounded just outside of Mexico City on February 15th, reports the Wall Street Journal. It is not known what the two were doing in Mexico, but they were operating in an official capacity. The White House issued a statement on the matter saying the two were serving their country. U.S. law enforcement regularly work with their Mexican counterparts investigating drug running and human trafficking. Elementary, Watson. A supercomputer named Watson, created by IBM, recently terminated two human contenders on the television game show Jeopardy. The massive computer, which received its questions in writing, was able to draw upon millions of encyclopedias, books, scripts, news reports, and other information stored inside its hard drive to reportedly think and process questions, find answers, and respond in milliseconds. It's the apparent future of artificial intelligence, where machines will be able to process unsorted information and provide answers much faster than human beings. Funny business with Oswald's coffin. Robert Lee Oswald, brother of accused JFK assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, insists that the Texas funeral director who sold the late Oswald's original coffin at auction was not the legal owner. The surviving Oswald filed a lawsuit January 14th in Tarrant County against Baumgartner Funeral Home in Fort Worth, saying he paid for the coffin in 1963 when his brother was shot 2 days after President Kennedy was allegedly assassinated by him. Lee Harvey's body was exhumed in 81 to debunk conspiracy theories. Alan Baumgartner kept the coffin, a plain pine box, and reinterred the body, said to be Oswald's, in a new coffin. He sold the old coffin, the table, and instruments used for embalming Oswald and some memorabilia, all for $160,000. Robert Oswald had assumed that Baumgartner destroyed the original coffin. If Robert gains possession of it, he plans to destroy it. News you may have missed. They had to know. Bernard Madoff, prosecutor for running the largest Ponzi scheme in American history, recently spoke out from his prison cell where he will spend the rest of his life. The banks he dealt with had to know, Madoff told the New York Times, but the attitude was sort of, if you're doing something wrong, we don't want to know about it. So what are the odds? The odds of dying from heart disease are 3-1. The odds of being on a plane with a drunken pilot are 117-1. The odds of being audited by the IRS are 175-1. The odds of injury from mowing the lawn are 3,623-1. The odds of winning an Olympics medal are 662,000-1. The odds of dying from a lightning strike are 1.35 million to 1. The odds of being a terrorism victim on a flight are 10.4 million to 1. Solar flares. Three of the largest eruptions from the sun, commonly known as solar flares, are set to hit the Earth in mid-February, worrying scientists that the charged solar particles will lead to disruptions in communications and other technology. Page 3. Adventures of the Bilderberg Hound. AFP editor makes Bilderberg documentary in Canada. Canada TV promises film will educate viewers on secretive group of powerful globalists, by James P. Tucker Jr. During a trip to Canada February 7th and the 9th, I spent countless hours being interviewed for what will be a one-hour TV documentary on what are officially called the Bilderberg meetings. Which parts fall on the cutting room floor will not be known until it is aired a year from now in February 2012. With others who have given me the Bilderberg workover, the History Channel, Channel 4 in London, and the Independent Film Channel, among others, airing would follow within 6 months. The young lady who interviewed me in Canada, Marie Claude Ellie Morin, explained that such a project takes a lot of work. She worked me to death. During the formal part of the session, she would say, "Repeat that comment about Bilderberg's meetings being a crime under the Logan Act, but look at and above the camera and inhale on your cigarette." Being a nice boy, as my late mother assured God every day, I would explain the Logan Act makes it a crime for private citizens to discuss public policy with federal officials behind closed doors. Apologists correctly say the Logan Act was passed in 1797, but it has not been repealed and remains the law, and it has been amended and expanded several times into the 20th century. She and the camera crew had me walk about town, go into a library, and examine books. But the orders for commentary never stopped. She wanted me to explain a lot about the secretive group of media moguls, corporate titans, high-level government officials, and royalty that colludes behind closed doors each year to make broad policy goals undemocratically. Repeat that comment about the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, and international financiers, but glare into the camera. So I said, growling, "They spill the life's blood on our young men and the heart's blood of our women by creating unnecessary wars so the manufacturing industry can make big bucks building tanks, jeeps, and warplanes." She said, "Give an example and keep glaring." I responded, "There are many," waving my book, Jim Tucker's Bilderberg Diary, at the camera. I did an advanced story on President Bill Clinton's invasion of Kosovo, and he's a draft dodger. I did an advanced story on the Bilderberg engineered downfall of Lady Thatcher as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Lady Thatcher personally confirmed this with me, eyeball to eyeball, saying it was a tribute to be denounced by Bilderberg. By then, we were walking back into the Holiday Inn where I was staying. She had me swing my briefcase widely and flip my cane threateningly and enter the front door twice. I had to walk the length of the hotel lobby so I could be filmed. She then said, "Explain this about Bilderberg forcing higher taxes as a step toward world government," looking somewhat bored toward and to the left of the camera. I responded, "I first exposed this in the 1990s. Bilderberg wants the United Nations to impose a direct tax on oil at the wellhead. This would be a direct tax on anyone who drives a car or mows the lawn. Now there are three such measures pending at the UN. It would start so low, consumers would not notice, but it would steadily increase. Such a direct tax would be a giant step toward creating a world government under the UN." Jim Tucker's Bilderberg Diary is by far the best book ever written on the activities of the Bilderberg Group. Get your copy of this 272-page book for $25 plus $3 shipping and handling from American Free Press. Call AFP toll-free at 1-888-699-6397 to charge. Page 4, Conspiracy Fact. Did Loner Act Alone in Shooting Rampage, by Victor Thorne. Only hours after the January 8, 2011 Tucson shooting, major news outlets such as National Public Radio, Reuters, and CNN initially declared Representative Gabrielle Giffords, Democrat Arizona, dead. The original reports of her confirmed death emanated from NPR, whose spokeswoman, Anna Christopher, stated that NPR used two different news sources, the Pima County Sheriff's Office and a local congressman. But what's extraordinary here is that NBC News correspondent Pete Williams said witnesses told police that they thought someone acted with the alleged lone shooter, Jared Loner. The conventional story says Loner acted alone. Gifford survived the ordeal. Indeed, Pima County Sheriff Clarence Dupnik, speaking just after the shooting, said on live TV, "And we're not convinced that he, Loner, acted alone. There was some reason to believe he came to this location with another individual, who may in some way be involved." Dupnik, a nationally known sheriff who chastised right-wing commentators for allegedly creating a climate of fear that fostered the shooting, said there were legal reasons not to discuss this matter anymore. He claimed more information on an accomplice would be forthcoming, but silence has been his only offering. A 911 tape later revealed a caller who told the dispatcher, "The guy wearing a black hoodie had a semi-automatic pistol. He started firing and then he ran." Other eyewitnesses agreed that an unidentified gunman fled the scene, if by all official accounts, bystanders tackled Loner and held him down. One of those present, a former ER doctor, was Dr. Stephen Rail. He told Fox News that he didn't think Loner acted alone. In addition, Pima County Police Officer Rich Castigar informed media members, A rifle with an extended magazine was found at the scene, but Lohner reportedly used only a Glock handgun. Moreover, a Tucson Citizen article reported, police arrest man near Thornydale and McGee Roads who is suspected of being connected to the shooting of Giffords and others. A third man is being sought. Meanwhile, doctors couldn't agree on whether Representative Giffords was shot from the front or behind. January 8th, Dr. Rail told the New York Times that the shooter approached from behind. January 9th, Connie Sexton of the Arizona Republic said the bullet entered the top of Giffords' head. January 9th, Lauren Neergaard and Amanda Myers of the Associated Press claimed the bullet entered the back of her skull. January 11th, Alicia Chang of the Associated Press contradicted an earlier AP report by claiming Representative Giffords was shot in the front of the head, not the back. January 11th, the Huffington Post reported the bullet entered from the back left portion of the brain. January 13th, AP added, doctors think the bullet pierced the front of Giffords' head. On February 11th, this writer asked a weapons expert if physicians can readily identify entrance and exit wounds. The man replied, doctors could easily make this determination. Even paramedics can tell the difference. As a bullet enters the head, it pushes the skull inward. The exit wound is then flared outward, creating a larger hole. The intern who rushed to Representative Giffords' side, 20-year-old Daniel Hernandez, stated that using his bare hands, he directly applied pressure to the entry wound on her, Giffords' forehead. He added, inexplicably, that he didn't even know there was an exit wound. Hernandez later mentioned to reporters how he held her wounds and there was so much blood. On January 9th, Jamie Rose and Mary Jo Pitzel of the Arizona Republic claimed, when they arrived at the hospital, Hernandez was soaked in blood. However, a photo taken as Giffords was being wheeled on a gurney toward an ambulance tells a different story. First, no one is placing any pressure on Giffords' head. A mere gauze pad limply covers her face. Hernandez, who said he maintained pressure on Giffords' head the entire time, is shown just holding her hand. There was no visible blood anywhere on Hernandez. Giffords had supposedly just been shot in the head, but the towel on her face has virtually no blood on it. An online marksman estimated that Giffords should have had at least a 3-inch exit wound, yet as she's wheeled away, no brain trauma procedures are being performed, and paramedics did not place an oxygen mask over her mouth or nose. On January 19th, the Washington Post cited individuals who allegedly viewed Safeway supermarket CCTV videos. They suggest that Lohner hurriedly walked out of the grocery store, approached the crowd, and immediately began shooting. They added that Lohner fired his first bullet into her face. Their account negates rally volunteer Alex Villek's depiction of Lohner asking questions and loitering in the crowd. Initial newscasts also pointed to someone in the crowd returning fire at Lohner. Or did this gunfire originate from a second shooter? Does the possibility of an additional gunman explain why doctors kept flip-flopping on where Giffords was shot? Regrettably, no video footage has been released to the public. Page 6, Technology and Freedom. High-tech advances could lead to 21st century slavery, by Frank Whalen. Today's readily available technology and the science fiction realities of tomorrow could herald a more capable, productive, and intelligent human being. But if not properly understood and applied, these dynamic advances could also lead to a future where mankind becomes more like a machine and less like a human being. The Internet's popularity represents an opportunity to shape people's thoughts in a certain direction and profit. Consider media mogul Rupert Murdoch's attempt to make millions of dollars from subscription-based content with his much-hyped new news website, The Daily, expected to dump at least 200 pages of news on readers every day. The Daily could be the success story for which elite profiteers have been waiting. Disturbingly, Obama administrators recently suggested creating an Internet ID under the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. Think of it as an operator's license to traverse the information superhighway. This program, by creating a single profile, would leave a digital track for all cyber activity, supposedly protecting people from online harassment, child exploitation, terrorism, etc. What is not highlighted is that such a trail would be a far more comprehensive monitoring system than any fingerprint or social security number. It could easily be doctored to plant evidence of criminal behavior. The idea of presenting something for entertainment or convenience, but then structuring it for security and safety, allows for total control and unimaginable profit. Aside from rewarded behavior, such instantaneous access to all things at all times changes the brain. British neuroscientist Susan Greenfield recently said, "We could be raising a hedonistic generation who live only in the thrill of the computer-generated moment and are in distinct danger of detaching themselves from what the rest of us consider the real world." A Greenfield biography on the popular website FortuneCity.com quotes this quirky researcher as also saying, "We would no longer have private thoughts. Rather, we would effectively be a mere node in the thinking conscious system. With the loss of private thoughts," Greenfield believes, "creativity and originality disappear, the wellsprings of human achievement." In a recent experiment to alter the brain, MIT researcher Dr. Leanne Young actually used technology to modify test subjects' moral views. "You think of morality as being a really high-level behavior," she says. To be able to apply a magnetic field to a specific brain region and change people's moral judgments is really astonishing, as quoted in an MIT press release dated March 29, 2010. The researchers used a non-invasive technique known as transcranial magnetic stimulation to selectively interfere with brain activity. A magnetic field applied to a small area of the skull creates weak electric currents that impede nearby brain cells' ability to fire normally, the news release adds. The toxic wireless soup of today's environment also has an impact. Electrosensitivity syndrome affects millions of people worldwide. It may cause mood changes, nausea, and possibly neurological disorders. Technology is like anything else, how it's used and for what purpose are what matters. When the lines blur between user and machine while the artificial intelligence of computers directs our lives, that is when genuine humanity and its good attributes will see not its decline, but rather its conceivable end. Dubious copyright claims stifle freedom of speech? By Keith Hansen. A growing number of independent writers and website owners claim that a Nevada law firm masquerading as a national media outlet is going around the country using copyright lawsuits like a cudgel to quash their First Amendment right to free speech. Founded in 2010, the company known as Right Haven LLC has filed hundreds of lawsuits in the past year, according to published reports. So far, only 70 have settled. Perhaps they shouldn't have. Representatives from the company claim it is a copyright holding company, but it is staffed largely with lawyers who travel the country filing lawsuits against burgeoning writers on the internet and bloggers who often use the internet to promote free speech and patriotic causes in contrast to the corporate media. AFP tried to contact Right Haven for comment, but no one would speak with us before we went to press. In an internet free speech matter concerning First Amendment rights, Brian Hill received an email January 27th notifying him that he was being sued for copyright infringement because of an image he posted on a news website that he opened himself in October 2009. Its content, which deals with patriot issues, does not generate any income. It is only for providing his views and other information to readers. The image in question was a photo that appeared in the November 18th online edition of the Denver Post, showing a below-the-belt pat-down by a Transportation Safety Administration employee at Denver's airport. Hill, a 20-year-old North Carolina resident who had no previous problems with copyright infringement, had used the photo to enhance his story about the controversial security procedure. He did not attempt to claim ownership of the image or to profit by it. Hill was informed that he was a defendant not by the plaintiff or the court, but by Las Vegas Sun reporter Steve Green. In a February 11th interview, Hill told AFP, "I first assumed it was fake because I had never gotten served by a court before, and it came via email, so I thought it had to be fake." But he soon realized he was being asked for his reaction to a lawsuit filed by Right Haven LLC. Green, who covers Right Haven's activities for his paper, was good enough to send a copy of the suit as an attachment. In the 6-page complaint filed in the U.S. District Court for Colorado, Right Haven stated that the nature of the action was for copyright infringement pursuant to 17 U.S.C. Section 501. Is Right Haven about protection or profit, or is something else going on here? Hill claims he lifted the image off a site he found using a common search engine, having no idea of the photo's origin. Hill posted the photo December 1st, but unbeknownst to him, Right Haven had purchased the rights to the Post photo on December 8th and filed suit against him on January 27th. Between December 8th and February 8th, Right Haven filed at least 34 suits over the same photo, according to a Sun article posted by Green. Eric E. Johnson, a University of North Dakota law professor who monitors Right Haven, wrote on his blog, "What's new and troubling with these latest lawsuits is that people being sued may have no idea that the photo they were using originated with the Denver Post. Since the photo went viral, it showed up in Google's image search results disconnected from the Denver Post." Hill phoned Right Haven and spoke to prosecuting attorney Stephen G. Gaiman, telling him that he had removed the picture. "But Gaiman began lecturing me about how I shouldn't be copying images without asking permission," Hill said. On February 7th, Hill finally received a summons from the U.S. District Court for Colorado notifying him that he was to answer the complaint within 21 days or he would be in default. 2 days after receiving the court summons, Hill phoned Right Haven again and spoke to settlement attorney Ike Adunze. "Adunze wanted me to settle for $6,000. I told him I couldn't pay that. He said I can make payments between $100 and $200 a month," Hill said. Hill, who was on Social Security disability, added, "I told him again how I couldn't pay that much. Then he reduced it to $50 a month and said that he could garnish it off of the Social Security disability payment." However, Section 207 of the Social Security Act, 42 U.S. Code 407, states, "None of the monies paid or payable under this title shall be subject to execution, levy, attachment, garnishment, or other legal process." Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. Tea Party pressures Republicans to cut budget by $100 billion. Thanks largely to heavy pressure on the part of the Tea Party movement, Representative Hal Rogers, Republican Kentucky, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, announced in mid-February some $100 billion in spending cuts for the 2011 budget proposal. It was good news for many Americans who are concerned the Republicans in name only, R-I-N-O's, rhinos, would move to block any of the substantial changes instituted by newly elected congressmen. Rogers had withdrawn an earlier proposal that did not cut deep enough after freshman congressmen who rode to office in a wave of Tea Party support had revolted against the paltry cutbacks, which amounted to about 1% of the total budget. The good news? Rogers said few federal agencies were spared the knife. Over $81 billion in funding would be cut from the so-called non-security sectors of the federal government. These include the Departments of Agriculture, Energy, Education, Interior, and State. The once sacrosanct Justice and Commerce Department, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency, are also facing billions in cuts. An additional $19 billion would be cut from the Homeland Security Department and other security-related agencies. Undoubtedly, a number of highly controversial cuts are being proposed. These include $747 million from the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, also known as WIC, a key program on which millions of American families depend. Some $350 million is also being taken out of the budget for border security fencing, and $5 billion is being cut from a program that would promote the construction of much-needed high-speed trains around the country. There is some bad news here, though. The Republicans not only exempted the military from any cuts, they actually raised the Department of Defense's budget by 2%, meaning the military-industrial banking complex will continue to line its pockets while soldiers and vets get nothing and the rest of the nation suffers record unemployment and more homes end up in the hands of the bankers. On January 13th, Representative Paul Ryan, Republican Wisconsin, a rising star in the Republican Party, told a popular Sunday morning talk show, "I'm not worried about Washington cutting too much spending too fast. The kind of cuts we are talking about right now are $100 billion out of a $3 trillion budget." House Speaker John Boehner, Republican Ohio, mirrored Ryan's statement. "It's incumbent on leaders in Washington to go out and help people understand how big the problem is. Then, and only then, should we begin to lay out an array of options for dealing with these problems." Patriot Act treason. House passes, Senate to debate extending rights-grabbing law. Following on the heels of the House's passage of legislation extending three of the most controversial provisions in the USA Patriot Act, the Senate voted 86-12 on February 15th to extend its own versions of the three provisions for three more months. AFP detailed the House version in its February 21st edition. The bill hands the FBI and other U.S. law enforcement three contentious and constitutionally questionable powers. These include the authority to conduct roving wiretaps, which allow the police to listen in on multiple means of communication without having to get a new warrant each time, engage in library snooping, which allows police to get a warrant to secretly probe what people are reading and writing, and track so-called lone wolves, which gives police the power to monitor the communications of individuals even if they have no direct relationship with suspected terrorists. Since the versions in the House and the Senate are different, the respective measures will have to go back to committee for a compromise. Congress will have to act quickly as the existing law enforcement powers are set to expire on February 28th. By the way, it's not just the ACLU that has come out against the Orwellian powers spawned by the Patriot Act. So far, representatives from the American Bar Association, the American Booksellers Association, the American Library Association, and the National Council of Churches have all spoken out publicly against this privacy-robbing law, a bipartisan effort to cater to illegal alien Hispanic voters. With this tough past election year over for half of the Senate, many key Republican senators are now going back to selling out the country on the issue of immigration. And who better to lead the charge than Senator John McCain, the Arizona Republican who only narrowly won his seat last November by going back to his conservative roots and taking a tactical, tough stance against illegal immigration. According to mainstream reports, McCain is once again willing to compromise on immigration reform, a euphemism for granting amnesty to the millions of illegal aliens currently hiding out in the United States. Fox News commentator Juan Williams wrote in a recent column that a bipartisan deal on immigration is currently in the works in Congress, with legislators in both parties expressing their support. Though no specific bill has been entered yet, Senators Harry Reid, Democrat Nevada, Charles Schumer, Democrat New York, Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, and McCain have all voiced their intentions to support a deal on immigration, which will have to address the millions of illegal aliens as well as their children hiding out in the United States. AFP readers may remember that during the lame duck session in December 2010, Reid tried every trick in the book to sneak through his DREAM Act, the controversial legislation that would have granted citizenship to millions of illegal immigrants' children. Democrats pushed hard for this bill, even introducing it multiple times in an effort to ramrod it through. Thankfully, the bill never gained enough traction to pass, but it looks like Reid may be at it again, and establishment Republicans appear willing to embrace the tidal wave of immigration out of a fear that they could lose power. That's exactly what appears to be happening in key states in the American Southwest, as Mexicans and Central Americans quietly conquer that area by migrating to these places in droves. Citing the 2010 census, Williams writes that racial minorities, overwhelmingly Hispanics, made up more than 85% of U.S. population growth in the last decade, and the largest increases are taking place in key 2012 presidential battleground states such as Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico. Hispanic newcomers across the red state South are threatening the GOP's hold on several congressional districts. Thankfully, as AFP has reported, Republican governors are not taking this sitting down. Across the country, new, tough, anti-illegal immigration laws have been passed similar to the one enacted in Arizona last year. In AFP's February 14th issue, writer Ralph Forbes detailed how at least 20 states have introduced or are preparing bills similar to Arizona's SB 1070, the landmark state bill that gives police the power to check the immigration status of anyone who is stopped for a crime and to deport them back to their country of origin if here illegally. Page 9, AFP on the Money. Financial Guru, Future Looks Dim, by Pat Shannon. It's not a matter of if the U.S. dollar will lose its status as the world's reserve currency. It's only a matter of when, financial wizard Porter Stansberry said last month. With the news that the New York Stock Exchange is being sold to Germany and the International Monetary Fund is searching for the dollar's replacement as the world's reserve currency, we can see it is already happening. Stansberry first announced a dollar crash in 2006 and is more certain about it now than ever before. In recent years, he warned his investors to avoid Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, General Motors, and a few dozen others that have since collapsed. Yet most people still are not ready to accept the enormity of his conclusions. Stansberry has gone out on a limb by saying that the complete financial breakdown will come to America by the end of 2011. This financial expert's prediction may not come to pass exactly this year, but when it does happen in the coming years, with more than 42 million people on food stamps, he says we should be prepared for street riots, massive arrests, and martial law. Most Americans who are able to avoid this turmoil will not know what to do when commodity prices soar. Who can fathom $20,000 for a loaf of bread or a dozen eggs or a gallon of gasoline? Or wallpapering a den with worthless currency? With several foreign nations already refusing the U.S. currency in their private marketplaces, Stansberry says when their governments repudiate our dollar, we will see a major collapse in the monetary system and our way of life. The one thing that has saved the United States so far has been the unique ability to create money at will whenever necessary. The United States is the only debtor in the world that can legally print U.S. dollars, and since World War II, the dollar has been known as the world's reserve currency. This is what banks around the world hold in reserve against their loans. We have been able to consume as much as we want without worrying about paying for it because our dollars are accepted everywhere in the world. So we haven't had to produce anything or even export anything to get all the dollars we need to buy oil and anything else the nation needed. All we have had to do was borrow the money and pile up debts. But if oil is no longer priced in dollars, the price of fuel will skyrocket and American lives will be changed overnight. All that needs to happen to provoke this is for other countries to start preferring payment in something other than dollars, and this is on the immediate horizon. When everyone is trying to get rid of their dollars, said Stansberry, and the government is printing more and more to try to pay debts, the crisis will reach epic proportions. Page 10, AFP on the candidates. Trump wants to be president, but will mob ties derail the flamboyant frontman? By Michael Collins Piper. Donald Trump's rise to stardom came as a consequence of his having been a flamboyant frontman for some unsavory behind-the-scenes sponsors. Here's a story. In his memoir, Trump proudly described how in 1987 he bought his first casino interests when he purchased 93% of the voting stock in the Resorts International, RI, gambling concern. What Trump didn't say was that RI was controlled by a clique of sordid international big-money elements in alliance with the Jewish Crime Syndicate, which was, in turn, collaborating with the CIA and Israel's Mossad in an array of interconnected money laundering operations. The casinos laundered money for the CIA and the Mossad. In return, these agencies used their influence to ensure the mob remained protected from interference by law enforcement. To understand where Trump fits in, we turn to RI's murky origins. RI evolved from a CIA front, the Mary Carter Paint Company, set up in the 1950s by then CIA Director Alan Dulles and his close associate, New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey, a leader of the Rockefeller wing of the GOP. While the company did in fact operate a national paint store chain, its real purpose was to function as a covert CIA money laundering operation. In 1958 and 1959, Dewey and several associates used CIA funds to buy a controlling interest in the Crosby Miller Corporation, headed by Dewey friend James Crosby, which was then merged with Mary Carter. The new concern laundered CIA money for the arming of the anti-Castro Cuban exiles and also launched lucrative gambling enterprises in the Caribbean where the CIA was active, having engaged the Meyer-Lansky crime syndicate in plots to topple Fidel Castro. How many law-abiding Americans who bought Mary Carter's paint would have thought they were funding a joint CIA mob operation posing behind the smiling face of a typical American housewife? The the fictional Mary Carter, whose visage adorned its products. In 1963, the company spun off its paint division and began focusing on its casino operations, particularly in the Bahamas. In 1967 and 68, Mary Carter changed its name to Resorts International and expanded. Several principal investors provided the assets. Meyer Lansky, the chairman of the board of the Jewish Crime Syndicate, David Rockefeller, who provided his family's clout with the CIA and in global banking to assist, the Investors Overseas Service, then the world's largest flight capital conglomerate, headed by notorious Bernard Kornfeld, who was no more than a frontman for two behind-the-scenes principals, Tibor Rosenbaum, the Mossad Swiss-based arms procurer, who headed the Banque de Crédit International of Geneva, the Lansky Syndicate's chief European money launderer, Baron Edmund de Rothschild, of the infamous banking family and a personal business partner of Rosenbaum and many Mossad-related ventures, and William Mellon Hitchcock, an heir to the Mellon dynasty, one of America's largest family fortunes, which has collaborated closely with the CIA for years. In 1970, the mob moved to expand legalized gambling on U.S. soil. Mob Chief Lansky called a high-level syndicate conference where the fading resort of Atlantic City was pinpointed as their new target. Prior to this, Lansky-controlled Nevada was the only outpost of legal gambling in the United States. RI's resources were used to finance a lobbying campaign that brought legalized gambling to Atlantic City, and RI quickly moved in. In 1987, upon the death of RI's nominal head, CIA frontman James Crosby, up-and-coming New York real estate tycoon Trump stepped in and bought Crosby's RI holdings. So while the name Trump appeared in the headlines, RI's real movers remained hidden from public view. Trump shed his RI investments in his much-publicized bankruptcy, but he remains a major player in the gambling industry, and now he may be running for president of the United States. Mike Huckabee's Shameless Trail of Broken Promises by Ralph Forbes. In the opening story in this ongoing probe on whether we should elect Mike Huckabee as president, I shared my role in helping him become governor of Arkansas. Analyzing his first campaign, his loss to Senator Dale Bumpers was due to key conservative Democrats, so Huckabee ran a conservative campaign appealing to the Council of Conservative Citizens, CCC. It worked. Huckabee became governor. When Governor Jim Guy Tucker resigned, Huckabee automatically became governor. With our man in office, we could finally clean out the cancers of Bill Clinton's corruption, or so it seemed. Here is my first disappointment with Huckabee. Clinton had 11 years and 11 months to build his machine. He let Walmart, Tyson, etc. do whatever they wanted. Tucker, handpicked by Clinton, continued building the machine. Tucker was convicted of stealing $3 million from the taxpayers. He occupied the office of governor illegally, thus all of his acts were null and void, including appointments, as spelled out in my lawsuit, which forced Tucker to resign. But after Huckabee became governor, he didn't replace any of these unconstitutional appointments. Huckabee began working with Steve Stevens, son of the notorious Clintonite operative Jackson Stevens. Until, in the strange world of politics, Huckabee, as Clinton did before him, double-crossed the enterprise. But Huckabee also double-crossed the taxpayers. By the summer of 2001, Huckabee's $160 million in pledged tax cuts had shrunk to $13 million. He had said additional taxes hurt the economy. Huckabee increased the sales tax, as well as taxes on diesel fuel and gasoline. He promised to get rid of the oppressive taxes on food and medicine, but he said he was focused on his re-election and that he would work for tax relief later. Instead, he openly sabotaged it. He repeatedly broke his pledge not to raise taxes. I then learned that Clinton had a secret dark wizard directing his campaigns, Dick Morris. Then I found out a shocking fact. Huckabee had the same dark wizard as Slick Willie for his secret political advisor as early as 1993, and still does. You guessed it, Dick Morris. Huckabee gladly spoke at CCC events, so when he received a second invitation to speak to the group, he did. The Simon Wiesenthal Center and others wrote letters to the press whining that someone who questioned the Holocaust was the guest speaker together with Huckabee. Huckabee, in response, turned on the CCC and said he had never heard of the group. But now that he is the leading pick in many GOP presidential polls for the 2012 race, such a fickle constitution is dangerous. Was he, after all, just an Elmer Gantry huckster, putting on an act to gain special interest support because he had lusted for the presidency? Can we trust such a man to be president? In the next installment, I'll share many more shocking revelations about this politician, especially his shameless betrayal of America for a foreign Middle Eastern cult of fanatics. But believe it or not, there are plenty of other leading contenders competing for the dubious honor of most shameless record. Page 11, Across the Nation with Mark Anderson. Ron Rand, Clash with Top Conservatives by Mark Anderson. Washington, D.C. The annual Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, is a bevy of strange bedfellows that, if located in another nation, could easily harbor enough views to form several political parties. But while the Swiss Confederation has 12 political parties, the American system bottles up nearly everyone's representation in just two dominant parties. Because of this, extremely divergent views must be forced under the same big tent. The resulting discomfort was strikingly evident at the February 10th to 12th CPAC, where Representative Ron Paul, Republican Texas, and his son, Senator Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, spoke alongside the likes of Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Newt Gingrich. On opening day, the seemingly upbeat climate soon became stormy as rifts surfaced between the anti-war CPAC participants who support the Pauls and the pro-war neoconservatives. The event, attended by 10,000-plus at the Marriott Wardman Hotel, was largely a who's who of these neocons, legendary for seeking to rid the world of terror and establish gun-barrel democracy, with a little help from the sons and daughters of America's middle and lower classes. It's rich man's war, poor man's fight, nonstop. One surprise was the appearance of tycoon Donald Trump, who may run for president in 2012 and will decide by June. "I am a committed fiscal conservative and a proud American," Trump stated. "We don't have free trade. We don't have fair trade. I love open markets, but not if they, China, are manipulating their currency." While making populist conservative overtures against gun control and abortion, Trump also predicted that gasoline could hit $9 to $10 per gallon. "Someone needs to tell OPEC those prices are coming down fast," he said, suggesting that a Trump administration would do just that. But when a sizable part of the audience yelled the name Ron Paul, Trump flatly replied, "By the way, Ron Paul cannot get elected." But contrary to Trump's claim, Paul still won the widely watched CPAC presidential straw poll for the second straight year. About 80 people stood up and clapped, but the same number loudly booed. Yet that was just the beginning of the fragile truce wearing thin among competing CPAC worldviews. The breaking point on February 10th came when former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld not only received the Defender of the Constitution Award, but also received it with the help of the next surprise guest, former Vice President Dick Cheney. The Paul crowd, many of whom harbor serious doubts about the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, saw this as a hard slap in the face. Many protested loudly and escorted themselves out of the main hall, even as Rumsfeld-Cheney partisans angrily rebuked the younger rebels with sanctimonious displays of servility to the graying bureaucrats on stage, who are major players in our interventionist wars on terror and were central to the official 9/11 story. Rumsfeld expressed no discernible regrets about the trillion-dollar terror war and joined Cheney in praising their former boss, George W. Bush, for protecting America from more attacks for over the last 10 years. Upon concluding, Rumsfeld slipped down to the hotel's bottom level to sign copies of his new book, Known and Unknown, while avoiding the press. Within earshot of Rummy, a Paul for President supporter from Pennsylvania told AFP he wants to know what happened to the $2.3 trillion that Rumsfeld announced is missing from the Pentagon back on September 10, 2001, on the eve of the attacks. AFP did meet former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who told this writer that he in no way supports a new 9/11 investigation on this 10th year since the attacks. Asked if accused 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden is still breathing, he replied in the affirmative. "It's the doctrine," he darkly intoned, saying that even if bin Laden is dead, someone else among the Islamic terror apparatus will haunt America based on the same terror doctrine. When pressed on whether the tapes from 80 video cameras around the Pentagon on 9/11 with never-before-seen footage should finally be released, Mukasey shrugged it off. The apparent CPAC standard bearer is former Representative Newt Gingrich, whose noontime speech February 10th was riddled with Ronald Reagan references and neocon ideology. Indeed, many in the GOP are literally searching for another Reagan, only to find that their actual choices so far leave them unsatisfied in their single-minded crusade to ensure Barack Obama does not serve another term. It boils down to the message of the two Pauls to rein in big government, with a strong emphasis on non-interventionism and other nations' affairs, versus the neoconservatives' warlike message that no war expenditure is too great if Islam is the target and ending terror is the goal. Senator Paul, while some supporters chanted "End the Fed," said he wants to quit piling debt on future generations. He emphasized the 10th Amendment to give the states more autonomy in the face of federal control. Citing the late Senator Barry Goldwater in the manner that Gingrich invoked Reagan, but Reagan tripled the national debt and grew government under the guise of shrinking it, Senator Paul quoted Goldwater as saying, "My aim is to cancel out old ones, laws, that do damage to the Constitution." Senator Paul added that, tough though it may be, he's serious about cutting $500 billion from the federal budget. That includes not only getting rid of the Education Department that Reagan said he would abolish but did not, it also means everything is on the table, including the military budget. Resistors, he said, are big government conservatives who cannot lay claim to balancing the budget. With that cunning comment, some of the audience booed as the line was drawn between the CPAC minority who would curtail military interventionism and those who see little else but the warfare state as their chief reason for being involved. Page 12, AFP on the Military-Industrial Complex. U.S. Taxpayers Fund Private Killers by Richard Walker. Erstwhile Soldiers of Fortune, or mercenaries, rebranded by the Pentagon as private military companies, PMCs, are hired guns not bound by the international rules of war, and they only answer to a complex web of global corporations. These PMCs are capable of putting a sizable army on the ground anywhere in the world with the most modern equipment and highly trained soldiers of all nationalities. They also provide jet fighter training, cyber warfare capabilities, diplomatic protection units, port protection, and specialized assassination teams. For America, which has been fighting two wars and running counterinsurgency operations far and wide, it has been cheaper to hire mercenaries, who are not paid pensions or guaranteed medical care. The rebranding process has been so successful since 2001 that the Obama administration has been able to spend heavily employing mercenaries. But that means American taxpayers are funding private armies controlled by corporations, many of them not even registered in the United States. That is why when President Obama says U.S. troop levels are being reduced in a given region, we must look beyond his claims and see how many of these privateers are involved. With support from Britain, the United States is formalizing the privatization of modern conflicts. PMCs have special teams for hire with in-depth interrogation and torture expertise. In effect, they can do everything a small nation might require of its military, intelligence agencies, special forces, Air Force, and Navy. While obtaining the exact number of mercenaries across the globe is difficult, it is reasonable to conclude from available data that there are at least 1.5 million, with 500,000 fully employed. Echoing the theme in the movie State of Play, featuring Russell Crowe as a Washington, D.C. reporter who uncovers a global network of private military companies, killing for profit has become a lucrative business. These PMC mercenaries are, as a rule, soldiers who have been trained to kill in regular armies and special forces units. They have skills to sell, which are in high demand even during a global economic downturn. The Pentagon and State Department have never produced exact figures for the numbers of mercenaries they have employed, though most estimates put the figure at over 150,000, and possibly as high as 250,000 during the height of the Iraq occupation. Without those boots on the ground fulfilling a wide range of functions, America would not have been able to conduct two wars simultaneously and undertake other operations in Algeria, Yemen, Somalia, and Iran, along with traditional commitments in South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. The role of mercenaries was back in the news recently with claims that Blackwater Worldwide, also known as XE, a major PMC that has earned close to $1 billion from the Pentagon, the CIA, and State Department, was being funded by Middle East interests to train an anti-piracy army in Somalia. Reportedly, XE had linked up with Saracen International, another big PMC registered in Beirut, to handle the Somali contract. Saracen was formerly Executive Outcomes, one of the most notorious mercenary outfits to emerge from South Africa's post-apartheid era. Both XE and Saracen have been reluctant to concede any involvement in Somalia, but even if they are involved, it is merely one contract. Various nations, companies, and corporations are vying to hire them. Across Eastern Europe, from Yugoslavia to Bulgaria, former soldiers are applying to join the highly competitive PMCs. Page 13, AFP on the military complex. Crooked defense contractors rewarded again, by Pete Papaheraklis. A recently released Pentagon report reveals that hundreds of corrupt weapons makers already accused of defrauding American taxpayers were still awarded $285 billion in new contracts over a three-year period. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent Vermont, requested the Report to Congress on Contracting Fraud as a provision to last year's defense spending bill. According to the report released by the Pentagon's Office of the Undersecretary for Acquisition, between 2007 and 2009, more than 400 contractors fell within varying shades of fraudulent practices, ranging from out-of-court settlements and civil judgments to suspensions and criminal convictions. Between 2007 and 2009, according to the report, $992 million in contracts were awarded to 43 contractors who were suspended from contracting with the Pentagon. About $682 million in contracts were awarded to 30 firms which had been convicted of criminal fraud. Moreover, $4 billion in contracts were awarded to 164 companies that had been debarred, while a whopping $280 billion in contracts were awarded to 91 corporations which had incurred civil judgments and 120 contractors who had settled charges of fraud. The list included heavyweights like Boeing and General Dynamics. The independent senator's quest to investigate the Department of Defense corruption started in the fall of 2009 in the wake of the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN scandal. The result of what became known as the ACORN standard, which holds that even a few employees of an organization stand accused of engaging in activities that appear to be inappropriate, then federal funding must be yanked. Notably, ACORN involved an undercover operation that led to Congress pulling the liberal organization's funding when it was revealed on tape that ACORN staffers were laying out plans for tax evasion, human smuggling, and child prostitution, according to Wikipedia and other accounts. The sad truth of the matter is that virtually every major defense contractor in this country has, for a period of many years, been engaged in systematic, illegal, and fraudulent behavior while receiving hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money, Sanders explained on the Senate floor. We're in fact talking about defense contractors who have received many billions in defense contracts and year after year, time after time, violated the law, ripping off the taxpayers of this country big time, he said. The senator concluded, with the country running a $14 trillion national debt, my goal is to provide as much transparency as possible about what is happening with taxpayer money. Sanders' provision also required the DOD to detail how it would punish the fraudulent weapons makers. In a classic dispatch of chutzpah, the Pentagon concluded its report by stating, the department believes that existing remedies with respect to contractor wrongdoings are sufficient. Perhaps it wouldn't be surprising if the DOD recommended that we free Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard and award him a photocopying contract at the Pentagon. Also, let's not forget that former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who's in the limelight with his new book but is not giving an update on the following, told the American people on September 10, 2001, according to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions. Rumsfeld's timing was impeccable, for the horrors of 9/11 occurred the following day. Now, 10 years later, one has to wonder what happened to that money. Was it ever tracked, or did it disappear into the Pentagon's deep memory hole? Page 14, AFP on the Mideast. CIA Mossad failed to predict Egypt revolt, by James Petras. The Arab revolt demonstrates several strategic failures in the secret police, special forces, and intelligence agencies of the U.S. and Israeli state apparatus, none of which anticipated, let alone intervened, to preclude successful mobilization and influence their government's policy toward the client rulers under attack. The image which most writers, academics, and journalists project of the invincibility of the Israeli Mossad and of the omnipotent CIA has been severely tested by their admitted failure to recognize the scope, depth, and intensity of the multi-million member movement to oust the Mubarak dictatorship. The Mossad, pride and joy of Hollywood producers, presented as a model of efficiency by their organized Zionist colleagues, were not able to detect the growth of a mass movement in a country right next door. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was shocked and dismayed by the precarious situation of Mubarak and the collapse of his most prominent Arab client because of Mossad's faulty intelligence. Likewise, Washington was totally unprepared despite the 27 U.S. intelligence agencies and the Pentagon with their hundreds of thousands of highly paid operatives and multi-billion dollar budgets. Several theoretical observations are in order. The notion that highly repressive rulers receiving billions of dollars of U.S. military aid and with close to a million police, military, and paramilitary forces are the best guarantors of imperial hegemony has been demonstrated to be false. Israeli arrogance and presumption of Jewish organizational, strategic, and political superiority over the Arabs has also been deflated. Israel's publicists in the U.S. who scarcely resist the opportunity to promote the brilliance of Israel's security forces, whether it's assassinating an Arab leader in Lebanon or Dubai or bombing a military facility in Syria, were temporarily speechless. The fall of Mubarak and the possible emergence of an independent and democratic government would mean that Israel could lose its major cop on the beat. The democratic public will not cooperate with Israel in maintaining the blockade of Gaza, starving Palestinians to break their will to resist. Israel will not be able to count on a democratic government to back its violent land seizures in the West Bank and its stooge Palestinian regime. Nor can the U.S. count on a democratic Egypt to back its intrigues in Lebanon, its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, its sanctions against Iran. Moreover, the Egyptian uprising has served as an example for popular movements against other U.S. client dictatorships in Jordan, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. For all these reasons, Washington backed the military takeover in order to shape a political transition according to its liking and imperial interests. Egyptian intelligence agencies are trained and financed by Israeli and U.S. operatives and are amenable to pursuing their master's will. They were so compliant in turning in reports which pleased their mentors that they ignored any accounts of growing popular unrest or of internet agitation. The CIA and Mossad were so embedded in Mubarak's vast security apparatus that they were incapable of securing any other information from the grassroots, decentralized, burgeoning movements, which were independent of the controlled, traditional electoral opposition. When the extra paramilitary mass movements burst forward, the Mossad and the CIA counted on the Mubarak state apparatus to take control via the typical carrot-and-stick operation, token concessions and calling out the army, police, and death squads. As the movement grew from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions, the Mossad and leading U.S. congressional backers of Israel urged Mubarak to hold on. The CIA was eventually reduced to presenting the White House with political profiles of reliable military officials and pliable transitional political personages willing to follow in Mubarak's footsteps. Once again, the CIA and Mossad demonstrated their dependence on the Mubarak apparatus for intelligence of who might be a viable pro-U.S. and Israel alternative, ignoring the elementary demands of the masses. The attempt to co-opt the old guard electoralist Muslim Brotherhood via negotiations with Vice President Omar Suleiman failed, in part because the Brotherhood was not in control of the movement and because Israel and their U.S. backers objected. Moreover, the youth wing of the Brotherhood pressured them to withdraw from the negotiations. Over the long run, it's not arms, billions of dollars, secret police, and torture chambers that decide history. Democratic revolutions occur when the vast majority of a people arise and say, enough, take the streets, paralyze the economy, dismantle the authoritarian state, and demand freedom in democratic institutions without imperial tutelage and colonial subservience. Page 17, Tough Talk from Jim Traficant. Foreign Intrigues Entangling America Worldwide by Jim Traficant. George Washington warned us of foreign entanglements. He cautioned, even giving aid to friends is unwise. Allies do not always remain our allies. Let's tell it like it is. The Congress of these United States has not listened to Washington. In fact, countless members of Congress turned their backs on our first president. So, America has become much more involved in world affairs than in our own affairs. Congress debates issues of the Mideast more than the issues of our Midwest. Every year that I served in Congress, I continually heard of new 5 or 7 year budget deals. I also heard about new Mideast summits, Camp David, at the White House, and other places where politician after politician took bows in one historic quest for peace after another. But these talks usually ended up with Uncle Sam giving more money to Middle Eastern countries to keep the lid on and make American politicians look and feel good. I believe peace can be achieved in the Middle East. My plan is simple. Just announce that all funds to the Middle East will cease until a lasting peace agreement is signed and maintained for at least a 12-month period. If this were done, I believe the matter of peace would take on a different character, and Camp David summits may not be necessary. My past House floor speeches provide some insight into this quagmire about which Mr. Washington warned us. When Congress debated a $53 billion bailout for Mexico on January 26, 1995, I stated, 81% of the American people oppose bailing out Mexico. I also said, Americans are worried about losing their jobs, health insurance, and pensions. They are worried about losing their homes. I have a question. When the steel mills closed in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where was Uncle Sam? When our farmers were losing their land, some even committing suicide, where was Uncle Sam? When people overseas are in trouble, Uncle Sam jumps in, but when Americans are in trouble, Uncle Sam says, let Willie Nelson take care of it. While Congress is debating bailing out Mexico, the Federal Reserve Board is debating too, debating raising the interest rates on our American people. Beam me up. Here are excerpts of a February 23, 1995 speech I gave. Down there in Mexico, there is waste, fraud, corruption, mismanagement, kickbacks, bribes, and conspiracy. There is even an armed revolution to boot. But Uncle Sam can fund $53 billion for Mexico. When Uncle Sam can say, sorry, Charlie, to Orange County, California, Washington, D.C., Youngstown, Ohio, and New York, but can fund $53 billion for Mexico, that says it all. And here are excerpts from a speech I gave on January 31, 1996. Uncle Sam borrows money from Japan and Germany and then gives this borrowed money to Russia, which then sells the nuclear technology, fighter jets, tanks, and submarines to Iran and China. Our military experts say that Iran threatens the Persian Gulf and China threatens Taiwan. If that's not enough to float your boat, the White House wants to guarantee part of a $9 billion loan to Russia. If we can guarantee loans for anybody, it should be for the people in the USA. Beam me up. Now comes Egypt, where we made Hosni Mubarak into our puppet. He stashed over $17 billion in banks all over the world. Now he's gone. Lord knows who's next. Congress should have heeded the advice of George Washington. Get back at me. Page 18, News and Views from AFP. Planned Parenthood's Genocidal Agenda Exposed by Keith Johnson. Recent undercover video footage obtained by Live Action, a California-based pro-life group, reveals an array of dirty secrets that Planned Parenthood wants to keep concealed from the American public. One of the scenes captured on film unfolds in a New Jersey abortion clinic where an anonymous pimp and his lady of the evening meet with a Planned Parenthood clinic manager. The man portraying a pimp complains of discomfort from a sexually transmitted disease, STD, and suspects that the source of this malady was one of the many underage immigrants on his payroll. He explains his involvement in sex work, then seeks advice on how to get the children tested without bringing undue attention to his sex slavery racket. The clinic worker is more than happy to oblige. She instructs him on how to get around consent laws by coaching the children to lie about their age and the age of their sexual partners. She also provides tips on procuring cheap contraceptives and where to find abortions at clinics that have fewer protocols. Shortly after this video surfaced, Planned Parenthood responded by immediately firing the clinic worker, claiming it was an isolated incident. However, at least 4 more videos have since emerged that reveal the same kind of collusion between Planned Parenthood staff and actors posing as pimps or prostitutes. Most recent footage was captured at a Washington, D.C. clinic where one staff member proves to be a most willing accomplice in helping the pimp get his underage girls tested for STDs. She also helps to arrange an abortion and lends advice on how to manipulate the system if they don't have insurance. Contrary to Planned Parenthood's claim, Live Action's multiple stings prove that the criminal behavior demonstrated at the New Jersey clinic is not an isolated incident. Planned Parenthood has a history of callous disregard for human life, as well as a penchant for skirting state and federal laws that are designed to safeguard against child abuse and exploitation. Critics of Live Action's undercover investigations complain that the group targets clinics in impoverished neighborhoods with dense minority populations. However, that's where 79% of Planned Parenthood's clinics are located. If anyone should be called into question for targeting minority populations, it is Planned Parenthood itself. Planned Parenthood has targeted minority populations from the very beginning. Its founder, Margaret Sanger, was instrumental in creating the Negro Project, a thinly veiled eugenics program aimed at curbing black population growth under the pretense of better health and family planning. Ms. Sanger introduced birth control to the black community and even enlisted the help of black ministers to spread her influence. Ms. Sanger was careful to conceal her true motivations from all but her closest allies. In a letter to Dr. Clarence J. Campbell, a pioneer in the birth control movement, Ms. Sanger writes, "We do not want word to go out that what we want to do is to exterminate the Negro population, and the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea, if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members." Today's Planned Parenthood, which receives over $360 million in taxpayer funding, is a legacy to Ms. Sanger's dream. Thanks to Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers, abortions are at an all-time high in urban areas, with 1,876 black babies per day being killed, according to blackgenocide.org, forumhealthcare.org, and other sources. But the reality is all races are affected, as the total abortion figure still hovers around 1 million per year, though the overall rate has declined slightly. Book exposes Chosen People's Goal of Global Conquest by Vince Ryan. All Americans must be aware that there are people in the United States whose sole business is to pursue, against any and all odds, their goal of world conquest, which they have been plotting since biblical times. It is no secret who these people are. Ariel Sharon, Israel's former prime minister, bluntly stated on October 3, 2001, "We, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it." The best account of the Jewish conquest of America and the world is Peter Christian's The Work of All Ages, the ongoing plot to rule the world from biblical times to the present. In 33 well-focused chapters, he demonstrates that the issuance and control of money, not any intellectual superiority, is their key to world control. After all, why shouldn't God's chosen people be in charge of the world He made? Many of today's Christians believe that the Jews of today spring forth from the chosen people of Old Testament times. The message of the book of Genesis is extremely important to the modern world. God Himself made repeated promises to His chosen people that they would be given the land of Canaan forever. This is the basis of their Zionist claim for the state of Israel and its eventual expansion from the Nile to the Euphrates. They are now planning World War III to bring this about and to complete their goal of world conquest, the author explains. Deuteronomy 20 sets forth the rules of holy war. In the case of lands outside of Canaan, the men must be killed, but the women, children, livestock, and property must be taken as spoil, Christian adds. The most successful conqueror in the history of Israel was David, who killed the Philistine giant Goliath with his slingshot. David was succeeded by his second son Solomon, who ruled for 40 years. In 597 BC, Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. In 538, the Israelites returned to their native land. By the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, the Jews have been expelled, as they have been expelled from at least 48 countries since AD 1012. But in exile, many became skilled in banking, tax collecting, foreign trade, commerce, law, medicine, spying, and other professional fields. They kept in touch with each other and developed an international community which exists to this day. The Jews had always looked for a Messiah. With the rise of Christianity, however, the known world began to change. The new religion's chief promoter was Saul of Tarsus, a Pharisee who traveled the Mediterranean and Asia Minor preaching the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus the Nazarene, who died to save mankind. The Christian church recognized him as a saint named Paul, but to the Jews he was a traitor. The letters that Paul wrote to the various churches he established are known today as his epistles and serve as a strong theological grounding for the teachings of Jesus, which was not the kind of Messiah the Jews had in mind. They wanted a Messiah who would set up an earthly kingdom ruled by them and eradicate their enemies. Author Christian says, "The difference remains important to this day. Zionism is a current political movement which has the goal of rule of the world from Jerusalem, not a heavenly kingdom after death." The Talmud is a revered Jewish rabbinical work highly critical of Christianity, often in a foul manner, Gentiles are seen as subhuman, and Jews are considered superior. The Talmud teaches that it is all right to cheat, rob, rape, lie to, or enslave Gentiles. For more details, be sure to read Chapter 7 of The Work of All Ages. Read this book from cover to cover and cherish it as a reference work when studying or discussing modern Judaism. The Work of All Ages, softcover, $25 plus $5 shipping and handling, is available from TBR Book Club. Send cash, check, or money order to TBR, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C. 20003. For faster ordering, call 1-877-773-9077, toll free, to order with a credit card.